Welcome to Now You Know. I'm Catherine Sussman. Today I'm speaking with founder and director of the wildlife protection charity ZooCheck, Rob Laidlaw. Rob, great to speak with you again today, this time on the subject of polar bears. Polar bears are such iconic animals. They're one of the star attractions at zoos all around the world, and ironically, often they're displayed in the most barren environments. Can you give us a bit of general information about them, how many are left, and lay out the problems, some are more obvious than others, associated with keeping this species in captivity?
Yeah, there's a lot of issues associated with polar bears. Certainly, most people who read the newspaper or watch news on TV will be familiar with the potential threat that climate change has on polar bears that are in the wild today. I think there's only about 20,000 polar bears in the world, with the bulk of them being in Canada. So here in Canada, we've got a very special place sort of in the whole polar bear spectrum. What I've dealt with over the years primarily has been issues pertaining to the keeping of polar bears in captivity. And there's about 600 or so polar bears in captivity worldwide. And like you said, they're iconic animals in the world of zoos. Many zoos want to acquire them because they're perceived as animals that will bring people through the turnstiles, thereby generating revenue and support for the facilities that keep them. And unfortunately for polar bears, there's been a very sort of narrow view of how they should be kept over the years, and that really hasn't changed very much. There was an erroneous notion in past, particularly when you looked at zoo design, that if you built exhibits that were largely hard, so made of concrete or that molded concrete, the spray-on concrete called gunite, and you made it look like blocks of ice, like the pack ice in the Arctic, then you were somehow simulating the environment of that animal. But of course, it was nothing at all like the Arctic environment. It may have superficially resembled some aspects of pack ice, but certainly had in no way, shape, or form replicated the actual environment that the animals would live in the wild. So you had these hard, basically concrete exhibits, many of them the old grotto-style exhibits with a moat at the front, and you had bears on these hard surfaces with very little to do, so they ended up pacing back and forth and suffering all kinds of psychological problems as well as physical problems associated with being on those kinds of surfaces.
It does seem that polar bear exhibits are among the most barren when you go to any kind of zoo facility. Why is that?
Well, I think that relates to the fact that polar bears live in the Arctic, and there's misunderstandings about that Arctic habitat. People see them out on the pack ice, and they don't realize that that pack ice is actually quite varied. There are open water spots, there are different kinds of ice, there are ice ridges. Many polar bears go along coastal zones where there's rocky beaches. They'll even go into areas of the boreal forest. You know, the habitats that polar bears live in are far more varied than you see replicated in the zoo. But, you know, this simplistic idea about where polar bears come from, I think, has informed the development, particularly in the past, but even so today, has informed the design of exhibits. And I think that when you look at polar bears in totality, when you look at their biology and behavior in the wild, you find that those things that they've been kept in, those types of old-style hard exhibits, are anathema to good welfare and good living for these bears. And what you want are just large, naturalistic environments with soft substrates where they can dig, where there's trees, where there's all kinds of complexity in the environment, and probably perhaps most importantly, space. Polar bears have been known to swim up to about 100 miles. You know, they may do that out of necessity rather than choice, but, you know, they can swim very long distances. They also walk long distances, and they're evolved to walk long distances. So in the Arctic environments where they live, it's not unusual to see bears walking 10, 20, 30, 40 kilometers in a single day and living in home ranges that measure in the tens or even hundreds of thousands of square kilometers. In fact, when you look at all of the terrestrial wildlife, polar bears are the widest ranging of all animals that live in terrestrial environments. So these are animals that require huge amounts of space, both terrestrial space and aquatic space. And you just don't see them being provided with any real amounts of space in captivity. In fact, there was a calculation done a few years ago that said the smallest known home range for a polar bear in the wild was more than 4 million times bigger than the biggest polar bear cage in the world. So what we're doing when we put these animals in captivity is taking these extremely wide-ranging animals and compressing them into microscopically small spaces. And then, of course, zoo people will say, well, oh, they do quite well. But I think it is incredulous that anybody, if they look at the biology and behavior of these bears, would ever think they could do well compressed into those small spaces, considering where they come from.
And how are zoos determining polar bears as doing well? Does that mean that they're able to successfully reproduce in captivity? Does that mean they're living longer than they would in the wild? How are they measuring that?
Well, they apply whatever is convenient. So they may look at longevity, but you know, for anybody who studies animal welfare, you know that longevity is just one factor amongst many. And you can have animals that have very long lives, but have very poor lives, that experience very poor degrees of welfare. So longevity is sometimes applied. You know, there was a bear in the Assiniboine Park Zoo in Winnipeg that was the oldest polar bear in captivity. Her name was Debbie. She lived to 43 years. And, you know, they were saying that was this wonderful thing, having this bear live that long. But when I saw Debbie, she lived in an old grotto-style exhibit on a concrete slab for her whole life. And I would say that, you know, that's nothing to celebrate her long life. It was a long life of misery and deprivation. But you also get other people that say if they reproduce, then that's something. But again, that's just one facet amongst many that have to be considered. Many animals have a strong biological drive to reproduce and will do so even in the most horrendous conditions. And one need look no further than humans. You know, humans all over the world will breed in the most dire conditions of poverty and deprivation. I think what you have to do is you need to look at how does that animal behave, move, and live its life in the wild. And if it can't do the majority of the things that it does in the wild, and if you can't keep that bear mentally and physically occupied, then you really have to challenge it being there. And when you look at most zoo exhibits, they're not able to do the things that they've evolved to do. And therefore, I think we need to question them being in those circumstances at all.
So you feel that they're actually one of the most ill-suited species to captivity?
Oh, absolutely. And I think if you look at the science, you see that, you know, coming out of the science. You know, everything about these bears really screams out that these are not good animals for captivity. If you were to look amongst the spectrum of bear species, you would probably say, well, maybe we could do it for black bears because they have, you know, much smaller home ranges and different kinds of lifestyles. But, you know, if you were to pick the worst suited bear, it would be a polar bear.
Where do zoos around the world get their polar bears? Are they mostly from Churchill, Manitoba here in Canada, or are they breeding them successfully? Where are they getting them?
Well, traditionally, they would get them from the wild. So there have been bears come out of Churchill, Manitoba, certainly. We track about 30 bears coming out of Churchill, but there have been a lot more than that. There have been bears, particularly cubs, that have been orphaned in northern Quebec, in the territories in Canada, that have been sent to zoos. There have been bears that have been orphaned in Alaska that have been sent to zoos, and also in Scandinavia and in Russia. So, you know, there's been a number of source points for wild bears. And then in recent years, there's been some breeding as well, although the breeding hasn't been enough to fill the exhibits that are currently vacant that, you know, in those institutions that want bears. But there's been a number of sources, but, you know, in the past, it's been primarily, as far as we can tell, bears coming from the wild.
Are we doing a good job of protecting our polar bears, or is it still happening that some of our wild bears are ending up populating zoos in foreign countries?
Well, I think, you know, every country could do a much better job. I don't think there's any country that's doing everything that it should to deal with climate change, to deal with pollution and habitat destruction. Certainly here in Canada, we have a very controversial allotment system for Indigenous peoples to hunt polar bears. And we still have bears that are coming from the wild. In fact, most of the bears in the new Assiniboine Park polar bear exhibit, it's called Journey to Churchill, were actually cubs that came from the wild. So, you know, I think we could do a much better job, not only with polar bears, but with most wildlife. You know, many people think that you know, we have all these protections in place, but, you know, many of them just aren't doing the job that they may have originally been meant to do. And we always need to look at how we can improve protections for animals and for the environments in which they live.
Are there any successful polar bear enclosures at zoos that you know of?
Well, it really depends how you define success, but, you know, as to fulfilling it, you know, every need that a wild polar bear has, I would say no. You know, in captivity, like the great ethologist Gordon Burkhardt would say, best that we can do in zoos and aquariums is deal with conditions of controlled deprivation. You know, that's a reality of captivity. So we can't, you know, do what really needs to be done, which is provide an opportunity for a bear to behave and live its life like it would in the wild. Having said that, there are much better exhibits. And those exhibits, and we have one here in Ontario, it's the Cochrane Polar Bear Habitat up in Northern Ontario. And, you know, there's some in Scandinavia and a few others in other places. You know, I think those types of exhibits that are large, they cover many, many acres. They have natural forests. They have natural terrain. They have sometimes ponds or lakes for the bears to swim in. You know, when you look at those types of exhibits, they really show if you're going to keep polar bears, you know, this is the way to do it. And, you know, we can't look at zoos and say this is the way to do it because they're not doing it very well at all. But if we look at these other types of facilities, then, you know, it really shows us if we want to keep polar bears for whatever reason in captivity, then, you know, we can do a better job. It's entirely feasible to do a better job, and we just have to. And I think part of that is recognizing that urban zoos that have a very small footprint, with a lot of animals, you know, they may just not have the space or the ability to keep these animals. And if that's the case, then they shouldn't.
Can you tell us a bit about what happened with the polar bear Yupi in Mexico? Just since we're discussing, you know, different standards of polar bear exhibits. So if you could just talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, we ran a campaign for a very long time to try to get Yupi, the polar bear, either improved conditions or relocated out of Mexico. Yupi was an orphaned cub that went to the Alaska Zoo in, I believe it was 1992. And a few months after that was sent down to the Morelia Zoo in Mexico. And had been there ever since that time. And Yupi was one of a number of bears that were sent to Mexico, and others were sent to other tropical countries. There's bears that were sent, you know, Taipei, Taiwan, to Singapore, to other places as well. But Yupi was one of these bears that was sent to a tropical country. Unfortunately, just a few weeks before Yupi was to be removed from Mexico, Yupi died. Yupi, I think, was bit of an icon for polar bears everywhere, polar bears that had been taken from wild environments in the north and sent to zoos in the south and were basically left to languish and, you know, served nothing more than a very crass kind of entertainment purpose. Some of these animals, and it's not just polar bears, it's all kinds of animals, they have this tenacity, they have this ability to live long lives. I've seen tigers that have lived for 15 or 20 years, so, you know, beyond their natural lifespan in the wild, in chicken wire cages in people's backyards. You know, some of these animals can live a very long time in the most horrendous conditions, and some of the polar bears do that as well.
What are some signs that a polar bear's welfare is, you know, just drastically compromised? Can you just give us an idea of what to look for if somebody's noticing this so that they can report it?
Well, one of the most obvious things that people see when they go and view almost any polar bear in captivity, there are a few sort of anomalous exceptions in some of these larger facilities, but, you know, in most every circumstance that a regular person would see a captive polar bear, what they'll notice is the pacing. And typically they will have a particular kind of pattern. Often it's moving forward 6 or 8 or 10 steps, and then moving backwards 6 or 8 or 10 steps. And you can see that they're placing their feet in the same exact spot each time. And at each end of that pattern, they may throw their head up. It's a ritualized head turn that's part of that pattern. In Singapore, you see bears that are swimming the same pattern over and over and over again. And when they push off the sides of the pool wall to go in another direction, if you stand there and watch, you'll see that they're doing that push off at the exact same spot in the wall every time they surface to breathe at the same spot. So everything is the same. And that's called a stereotypic behavior, which is just a meaningless repetitive movement. You don't see these in the wild. You see them in captivity because they're largely a product of captivity. A lot of polar bears, particularly in the hotter countries, are lethargic. In fact, there was a study done that showed that polar bears were inactive 70% of the time.
Not common. I know with other species like tigers, they are inactive for large, you know, for most of the time. But does that not apply to polar bears?
No, because, you know, there are periods of the year at which a polar bear will be inactive. And certainly, you know, a female denning with her cubs and all that, it's going to be inactive. But if you look at how they spend their time, you see that they actually are, you know, these very active animals. They have to hunt, they have to move. There are all these things they do during their daily lives, and they're not able to do those things. So if you see a polar bear or any other animal where you go back again and again and again, and it's not doing anything, that's a problem. And a lot of people don't see that inactivity as a problem, but it really is just as abnormal as those weird pacing behaviors or the repetitive swimming patterns. You know, I mentioned that the bears become pear-shaped rather than the shape of, you know, the elongate shape of a polar bear in the wild. They may have dull fur. They may lose some of their fur, so you can see the black skin underneath, and that's often in places where the climate isn't appropriate for them. They have that hair loss. They lose their blubber layer because they're not, you know, they're not eating seals and other marine mammals, and, you know, so they're not getting that high fat content that feeds that blubber layer. You'll get a lot of bears that become very gaunt looking. You know, you can look at those bears and you don't need a PhD in zoology or you don't need to be a vet, but a lot of polar bears, you can look at them and they just don't look good. And
what do you recommend a person does if they notice a polar bear or any animal in a bad situation?
It's tough, but certainly, you know, one of the big impediments to helping a lot of these animals is that not enough people make their opinions known. So, you know, letting a zoo know, hey, this is not appropriate. Maybe you should make improvements, or maybe you should think about transferring that animal where it can be in, you know, more appropriate accommodation elsewhere. People have to speak out. They have to speak out to the authorities that monitor and provide oversight to these facilities. And they have to speak out to their elected representatives in every level of government. There are other things people can do as well. They can certainly be letting their colleagues, their friends, their family know about their concerns. And they can be spreading their concerns even wider by contacting media, writing letters to the editor, writing opinion editorials. Newspapers all over the world do those kinds of things and accept that type of content from members of the public. So it's, you know, creating that conversation. And what's surprising is that a lot of people don't want to do that because they think, well, I'm the only one who's concerned. But when you do get instances of people speaking out, others then step in and speak out. And you see this with all kinds of instances where animals are not doing well in zoos. Like Newt the polar bear, you know, the polar bear cub that became a global sensation. Once people started speaking out against, you know, what was Newt's fate? How was Newt being treated? So many more people came to that discussion saying, I thought the same thing. But, you know, when you looked at the propaganda that was out there initially about Newt, you would think nobody was concerned. So, you know, if you had that concern, you know, you'd be alone. But when you speak out, you find that there's probably lots of other people that think the same way. So you're not going to be alone. And certainly that was our experience with Yupi in Mexico. We had tens of thousands of people signing petitions, groups protesting the zoo, all kinds of activities with local people speaking out. And I'm sure many of them thought when they went and saw Yupi, well, it's just me. What can I do? I'm alone. So, you know, create that conversation. Create that conversation and you'll find that it quickly expands.
Especially today with social media, things catch fire so quickly. So
Exactly.
Before you go, can you tell us about the current climate change related problem of orphan polar bear cubs in Canada?
Well, right now, the most significant area that a problem is Churchill, Manitoba. And for anybody that doesn't know Churchill, it's in northern Manitoba. It sits on the coast of Hudson Bay and is considered the polar bear capital of the world because historically bears would congregate right in that area because that would be the area of Hudson Bay where the water would first freeze and then the bears would disperse over the ice hunting for seals. So polar bears would come to Churchill, and that's why it's a great place to go and see polar bears in the fall. But, you know, there's a long history of human-bear conflict in Churchill, and there used to be something called the three strikes, you're out policy, where if an adult bear came into this area of the town and an adjacent area that went all the way out to the airport and the garbage dump, if a bear went into that, it's called the primary control zone, multiple times it could be deemed a problem bear and then be captured and sent to a zoo in the south or in other parts of the world. The same would apply for cubs as well. That policy was changed in the 1990s. We got it struck down, and then they brought in a Polar Bear Protection Act. And what's surfaced in recent years now is cubs that are once again being taken from Churchill and being sent to zoos. And there are more people now speaking out about this, saying, is this really what we want to be doing? They're, you know, maybe we should just leave them on their own in the wild. And if they die, they die. And if they survive, they survive. Other people are saying there's got to be other options. Could we provide supplemental feeding? Could we, you know, have weigh stations that hold the bears until they get a bit older? Are there ways of rehabilitating bears? And in fact, we were involved in facilitating through our campaigning, the Born Free Foundation coming in and doing a trial, a surrogacy trial, where orphan cubs were introduced to wild female mother bears with cubs. And unfortunately, the government shut that down after only 7 cubs. And
why is that? Just a very expensive program?
No. It was that the optics they felt wasn't good. But, you know, part of the problem was that there wasn't really an ability to track them very well. And so nobody really knew what was happening to these cubs once they were introduced to the wild surrogate mothers, because they would disperse over the ice and, you know, you couldn't really track them. The technologies today are much better. We can track them. So we're advocating to resurrect the surrogacy program and give it another try. 7 animals is not very many. If you look at other animals like California condors and black-footed ferrets and all kinds of other animals that have been reintroduced to the wild, they're doing dozens, if not hundreds, of animals to work out the protocols. So 7 is not a lot of bears to base a decision on. It really should be extended. And there's lots of evidence that it should work.
Are you having any luck getting that extended? When will you know about that?
Well, we've just hired somebody to produce a paper, and we're not aware of any other paper like this, looking at non-zoo options for polar bear cubs. And we think that there are some options available, some of them that I mentioned, but certainly high on the list would be resurrecting the surrogacy programs. And we think there are precedents with other animals that experience, other predatory mammals that experience that learning curve of the youngster being with the mother, that would be somewhat analogous to the polar bear situation. So we think there's probably a lot of promise, but we really have to sort of pull this all together and flesh it out. And that's what we're doing. And certainly I think the town of Churchill is interested in looking at these things. And I believe the Manitoba government is now at a stage where they realize we just can't take every bear that might be in trouble and send it south to a zoo. You know, there's got to be another way of doing this.
Rob, thank you so much for your time today and all that you do on behalf of animals, both here in Canada and abroad. It's amazing.
Hey, thank you.